Okay, so as I said, I'm going to talk about the organization of matrices, and this is part one of the talk, and you can take that as a thread if you'd like. There will be a second part. So in the first part, I'm going to briefly mention what I'll be talking about in a second. Now where? Okay, so let me just start by saying that the theme of this talk is the grouping and reordering of data matrices. So we've heard a little bit about a couple of data matrix problems and data matrix examples, and I have almost a philosophical point to make. And hopefully I'll be able to make that point and show you an example of a data set which I think is well adapted to this sort of ideas I'm going to talk about. And then I'm going to hopefully surprise you in the second talk by talking about another data set which you probably wouldn't expect is related, but I claim it is. Okay, so let me start by explaining the setting here. So in a lot of typical data analysis problems, you have essentially two sets of objects and some data function defined on those two sets of objects. So if you like, I'm just calling them for now x and y. I'll do an example in just a second, but you have some cloud of points x, some cloud of, say, maybe documents, and some cloud, say, y of words contained in those documents, and you have a data function measuring somehow an interaction between those two things. Say, the Science News data set, where maybe X is a set of documents that appeared in this Science News magazine, and Y is a set of words or word fragments that appear in these articles. And I think there was another speaker who talked about this, so I don't feel too much obligation to say a lot about it, but you could then generally define some sort of data matrix gamma on X and Y, which measures the interaction of X with Y, say the frequency of occurrence of some word in some document. Okay? So this is sort of the setting I have in mind. And let me skip that part. Okay, so the traditional approaches here, generally speaking, what you do is you take this data matrix and you look at the data for, say, one object x and two different objects x, say xi and xj. And you use this affinity defined for all y's. So say you're looking at two documents and you look at all possible words and you use these vectors, if you like, to define some sort of affinity between documents. So if two sets of documents have similar sets of words and they occur with similar frequencies, you say they're similar documents. And usually you use this sort of affinity to do some kind of data analysis task, learning, extending a function, classification problems, these kinds of things we've seen a lot of examples of. And I think we've seen quite a few examples of this approach in the last week. Okay. So, for instance, in the Science News, to be a little more specific, for each two documents, we could look at the frequency of occurrence of all the words. We define an affinity based on having words in common, having many common words, and say maybe we're interested in extending some, we learn some relationship between the affinities and the document classifications, because we're interested in having a new document for which we can compute these word occurrences, and we're interested in, say, classifying that document. So I think this is a fairly familiar setup, and I don't want to say a whole lot more about it. So here's a sort of a graphical representation. I said we had something about matrices. Well, here's a matrix, and we can view, say, the rows as a document, and the columns are our words, and the entries are the frequencies of occurrences of those words in that document. And so we can view two documents as rows in this matrix. And what we do generally in the traditional approach is you group two objects if those two rows are similar in some sense. Okay? So why is this an unsatisfactory most of the time? I mean, this works relatively well, surprisingly well sometimes. But there are a number of reasons we should be very suspicious of this. And one of them, and probably the most important, is that these sorts of global relationships between documents are really not a good way to look at data. So often they're only the only starting point we really have to work from, but they're often not what we'd really like to do. So let me just illustrate what I mean. You can have two Science News documents, which globally look very different, have very few words in common, but are very strongly related. They have a set of a few words in common. Maybe they're anthropology articles and they have anthropology words in common, but then they're talking about different continents, different cultures, different locations, and so they have nothing else in common. Okay? And let me give you a great example due to Connie, which I thought was just one of the best examples I've heard. So you've heard of the football player Tom Brady, and if you haven't, he's a famous American football player, a quarterback. And you've heard of the model Giselle. So a very famous supermodel Giselle. If you do a search, say in Google, for Tom Brady, you'll come up with football articles. If you do a search for Giselle, you'll come up with fashion articles, but the two are dating. And if you put Tom Brady and Giselle, you'll come up with gossip articles. Okay, so context is everything, and that is a brilliant example. Thank you. So context here is everything. You cannot look at these two objects globally. You might decide if you looked at the entries that come up in Google and you do Tom Brady, that had mostly to do with football, and Giselle, mostly to do with fashion and clothes, you might have no idea that these two are connected in any way. But there's some subset of articles in which the two are connected. Okay? So what I'm saying here, basically, if you want a graphical demonstration of this, is that we should really be interested in local information. If we have this kind of data matrix, we should be looking at a subset of X's and a subset of Y's and trying to figure out relationships, try to find rectangles like this that map X's and Y's based on some commonality between them. These are rows that are linked because they have similar responses to those columns, not because it has anything to do with the global response. Okay? So here's sort of the goal that we have in mind. So what we want is some sort of decomposition of our rectangle, our data matrix, into rectangles. And here, in the Science News example, each rectangle consists of a set of words and a set of documents. And what we want is when we want a rectangle to mean something, it should have low variance in some sense. However, we'll define that later. But what we mean is that if I look at the documents in that group and the words in that group, there shouldn't be a whole lot of variation across that rectangle. Okay? And in this case, I drew some sort of overlapping covering. There's no particular reason that these rectangles should be overlapping. Maybe you want to tile the whole plane. Maybe you want overlapping. Maybe you'll hit everything. It's not clear that such relationships always exist, that you can always find a group of documents and a group of words that have this kind of low variance. Okay? So let me point out one way that you might go about building this kind of variance, this kind of structure. And that's to build a partition first of X and a partition of Y. So what I might do is I might go about building a multi-level partition of my rows. What I do is I look at two rows and I start to group them based on their global affinity. Okay? And then I look at groups of rows and maybe I group those based on their affinities. And I can do the same thing for Y. So what I'm trying to do is group a set of X's that talk to each other in some sense, meaning that the affinities are, meaning that the data matrix is similar across the columns. Okay? And so here's sort of a visual demonstration. You have two groups of X's, and you group them together to be one group. Okay? And you build a multi-level partition this way. So let's see if I have a picture here. Well, I have a description. Okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Uh-huh.
In those rectangles, are you acquiring homogeneity that most of the numbers are similar, or it's enough that you have a low rank within those blocks?
So you're kind of getting to the point that low rank is eventually what we're going to look for in some of the examples. But here, you know, the problem is that you have to start globally, and homogeneity globally doesn't mean a whole lot. Let me say one thing before I answer your question, sort of. So there are all sorts of games you can play with building these kinds of partitions. There's no particular reason that you want to look globally at X. What you generally want to do is some sort of recursive process where, say, you build some partitions on X based on global information. And what you're hoping is that there's some common subset of X, and that you can pick out, if you have two X's that are very similar, they'll have some set of Y's in which they're very similar. You'll grab that with the global affinity. That's sort of the starting assumption, that there's enough similarity in some of these things to start grouping X's. Okay? Then maybe once you've formed a partition of X's, you look at the Y's. And now you can look at the Y's, say, just by either globally, or you can look at the partitions you've already formed for X. So if you like, like, you can do something like this. You can start by grouping one set of the objects, say the documents. You create some groups of documents based on global word affinities. Now you look at words. So here are some words, and here are some documents. Okay. Now let's say you can start grouping, creating a group of words, either by looking at it globally or by looking at its values on some of the documents that you've begun to group together. Okay. And what I'm saying is that the level of homogeneity you're looking at for varies a lot depending on what scale you're looking at. Does that kind of answer your question? No. Well, if you have another one,
we'll see later.
Okay. So the point here is that this is just one way of doing this. There are a lot of games you can play here, and I'm not sure what works best. But this is one thing you can do. You can build a sequence of partitions of X and partitions of Y in this kind of manner, so that basically the sets at the first level form the sets at the second level by you. So you take a disjoint decomposition of X, and at the next level you take some unions of those disjoint pieces of X to form the next partition. Okay, and this is what I'm calling a multi-level partition. So it's just a sequence of disjoint unions of X, so that at level J, the sets are formed as unions of level J minus 1. Okay, and of course you can do the same thing for Y. And here's a visual example of what I'm talking about. You can talk about, say, just the line, and I divide it at the first level into four sets, and I take unions of those sets to form larger partitions, and so on. And now what this gives us is a set of tensor products. I can take all possible subsets I formed of X, all possible subsets I formed of Y, and I can consider the tensor products. I can take any subset S and any subset S of X and T of Y, and I can consider their tensor product, or their cross product if you want, and that corresponds to some submatrix, my data matrix. Okay? And what I'm generally going to do, or at least one way to do this, is to define some sort of cost function based on the variance of the data function on these things. So I just want to take some sort of measure of how that changes over time. And I
over the corresponding what? You're just going to look at the rectangle, or what?
I'm generally speaking going to look at the rectangle. Yes.
Okay.
So this is, I'm assuming the only data I'm given is some kind of data function on S cross T. So I'm going to define a cost function on S cross T, and particularly on the data function I'm given at those values. Okay. And then say I find the optimal covering by sets of this form. And optimal means maybe I minimize or maximize the sum of the cost function. And this gives me some sort of disjoint covering of this by some best decomposition of this thing by tensor products. So you could think of this as the decomposition which minimizes variance. Okay. So, and let me say that you cannot hope to sort of capture what you're looking for with one of these. Generally speaking, there are a couple games you can play again, but the simplest is probably to take many redundant decompositions of this form of your matrix. So you have some randomized process, say, involved in the partition building. You do this k times, and you build k pictures that look like this with different decompositions. Okay. Any questions here about this?
Uh-huh. Do you do any permutation?
So the partitioning has nothing. I'm drawing pictures where everything's continuous, but generally speaking, partitioning has nothing to do with the order.
So pretty much you're learning with permutation also.
Yes, essentially. You learn a permutation up to an ordering of the smallest subgroup when you do this kind of thing, right? So you can also, I suppose, call this talk reordering in the sense that when you have one of these kinds of decompositions, you've essentially chosen an ordering of the matrix up to the smallest level. Any other questions about what I'm doing here? So this is what I mean by a philosophical point. My philosophical point is just that when you're looking at data matrices, you cannot hope to do things globally. You can only hope to take some groups of X's and some groups of Y that are related through this data function. You cannot hope to find some sort of global affinity between the X's and global affinity to the Y's that's going to make sense. Okay? That's sort of the philosophical point I'm trying to make. Okay, so let me just, there are a lot of things you can do once you have these kinds of decompositions. You can build TensorFlow series if you want. You can do all sorts of games, but let me talk about the simplest possible game. So suppose I have the affinity function defined everywhere but at one point of my matrix. And now I've taken many of these redundant sort of decompositions. What can I do? Well, I can look at the rectangle, say, containing that point in each of those decompositions. And that rectangle is a rectangle of low variance. So what that means is that the values there should essentially be the same, or the missing value there should be predictable for that rectangle. Okay? And I can spin this. What I can do is look at several redundant decompositions, look at the rectangle you find from each such decomposition, and average them together in order to predict the outcome of this value. So what I'm doing is looking at, literally, if you like with science news, what I'd be doing is looking at different groups of documents that have some relationship to a document, and different groups of words that have some relationship to that word. And I'm literally, so I'm taking,
so you're using global information to decide that that's in a rectangle?
What?
You're using global information to decide that that's in a rectangle.
Well, not necessarily, no. I mean, the rectangles, I'm not sure what you mean exactly.
Well, if nothing was ordered, then you wouldn't know that that red dot is inside.
Well, no. I have some set of, I have a dot, and I have some set of rectangles that covers it. So okay. I find that in this particular decomposition, that rectangle is in that dot. Is that what you mean by global information?
Yes.
You have a point that you have to be able to associate things with the rectangles. You're right, I claim this is an easier problem, an easier learning task than most, because what you're doing is you're given all the values but one for that document, and all the values but one for that word or something like that. But, okay. Okay. But the idea is to take a set X and a set Y, say of words and documents that were closely related, to identify the point in this rectangle and to use that value. Okay. So I'm just trying to give you an example of what you can do with these things. There are a lot of different ideas. So this is sort of the philosophical outlook of what I'm trying to do to form these sort of partitions that describe data sets and describe the structure of data matrices, say, in a more complicated way than just a global affinity. And let me go ahead and describe a particular data set and how I might go about forming these for that particular set. Okay? So the data I'm looking at is from the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. So this is a set of survey questions. And this consists of this particular, there are several variations of this, I believe, but MMPI consists of the particular one I'm using, 567 yes and no questions. And these were constructed by psychologists in a way to measure certain responses. What they did is they created a large list of questions, maybe several thousand. They gave a number of volunteers the survey, asked them to fill it out, and they took known groups of people, people they knew were depressed, people they knew were had a clinical diagnosis, and they chose questions that were able to predict these things, the answers to which were able to predict these things. So, and these surveys, just to give you an idea, are used in employment tests, career counseling. I think they're occasionally used in drug rehabilitation programs, things like that. Okay, so I'm sworn not to talk too much about the questions because people try to cheat on these tests. They are given for things like employment, and there are people out there who are trying to get the copies of the questions and so on. So I'm going to try and tell you a little bit about them without giving away too much information. So the survey questions are mostly in the form of declarative statements, and they range over a wide variety of topics. Some of them are very direct, and some of them are very subtle. And here are a couple of the questions. Here's a sample. So I would like the work of a carpenter. I played with dolls when I was a child. I hate my family. Fire terrifies me. I think about killing myself. My joints often ache. So this is These are not actual questions from the survey, these are in the style of the survey. So I modified them slightly to make it a little. Okay? And they range the gamut from completely innocuous to I hate my family and I want to kill myself. So what does this thing look like? This is just a picture. You're not supposed to get any particular meaning out of this. It's just a pretty picture. This is a matrix of answers to this question. So we have a data set consisting of 2,400 some odd people's answers, and we put it in the form of a matrix. We have 567 questions, and we take a 1 if the person answered yes, and a negative 1 if they answered no. And for the most part, this is a dense matrix. There are a couple places where people have chosen not to answer a question. So you see a few yellow entries, those are values where people said, I'm not willing to answer that question. And we filled in zeros for there. And for the most part, I'm going to ignore them because they're a very small sample to test, and I don't think they really change anything. So this is a particularly nice and simple data set for a couple reasons. One is that this is a dense survey matrix. So a survey matrix is very simple. You either say yes or you say no to some question. So there's no issue of values or assigning some sort of difficult meaning to the entry. It's pretty clear, yes or no. And it's a dense data survey. We actually have answers to just about all the questions for just about all people. If you look at some other data sets, like say Amazon.com, where they track who bought what book, this is essentially a sparse creature. You might be very strongly related, and you might have two people who have the same interests who don't actually buy the same book. You have to deal with that somehow. Okay? And of course, another example might be that's perhaps even more complicated, something like the Netflix ratings. So there you have a list of people and a list of maybe 100,000 movies, and people have rated certain movies they've seen. And now you have both a value and something very sparse. Again, you can have two people who both like Westerns, and they've seen very few Westerns in common. Okay? So this is kind of a nice starting place, a nice simple data set. Relatively. It has the difficulty that it's not based on anything physical, it's based on people's answers to questions, which has a lot of noise and some inherent unpredictability in it. Okay. So the kinds of things we're interested in with this data set, we might want to predict a psychological score. So psychologists take the answers to these questions, and they have a formula or a procedure for scoring these things and saying you're depressed or you're schizophrenic or you're paranoid and you need further evaluation. Employers take these things and do some kind of scoring and say, I trust you to be the janitor and give you the key to the janitorial closet. This is the sort of use people make of this test. We're also very interested in the interaction of this kind of data set with other data sets. So suppose we have a group of people and you answer a survey we give you, and we have something about, say, music that you've bought from Amazon.com. Say anything about the two jointly. Extract some information from the survey or from simple answers to questions that allow us to predict something interesting about you.
Can I just say something about the survey? So it's actually very widely used. So it's used not only for employment, but also for parental rights, for convicts to see if they're suicidal or dangerous to other convicts. So it's widely used.
It's used in drug rehabilitation programs.
Yes.
Yes, it is very widely used.
So there's quite a bit of predictive value, like SAT score?
Yes and no. It does have some predictive value. They build these test scores in an empirical way to try and account for people cheating, to try and account for people who don't want to answer questions. Basically what they do is they give the questions to a large group of people who have some known attribute, some control group and some general group, and they pick a subset of questions based on their ability to predict whether someone's in the control group or in the, say, the group of depressed people who have been clinically diagnosed as depressed. So in that sense, yes, there is some predictive value here. Okay, so what I want to start by doing is defining one of these sort of global affinities or a way to group things. And I'm going to start by talking about questions. And so I want to figure out how to define an affinity between two questions given this data matrix. So we have our function gamma on a set of people and a set of words, and I want to define some sort of an an affinity between two questions based on the responses of a set of people or a set of people to those questions. Okay? So to give you an idea, I just take a vector x and a vector y representing each of the different questions, and I organize all the responses of the people in a group P, either negative 1 for no, 0 for I didn't answer, or 1 for yes. And there are a lot of sort of metrics you can define on x and y, and I claim there's essentially one interesting parameter. You can do almost any of these tests will work. You could take an inner product between x and y and measure angles. You could try and form the norm. Or say you can go to statistics 101, which is what we'll do in just a second. So if you've taken stat 101, you might remember there's something called the Pearson chi-square test for independence. And this is usually used in this kind of setting where you have survey questions, and you're trying to determine whether the questions are related in some way or not. So what is it? Well, let me start by talking about the Pearson chi-square test. So most of you probably know something about this, but the idea is that you have a random variable z, and you'd like to test whether it has a certain probability distribution. And I'm going to assume it's a discrete random variable that has n possible values. If it doesn't, you can bin values and so on. It's not really a difficulty. So we're going to test the null hypothesis that z has a certain probability distribution. So what we do is we run some many occurrences of z, and we record the observed number of frequency of occurrence of each of the possible values of z. So we roll a six-sided die 1,000 times, and we record how many times we get 1, how many times we get 2, and so on. And we'll let O sub I be the number of times we get I. And now we're going to look at the expected frequency, assuming that we were correct about the probability distribution. If we actually knew how z was distributed, we were right, EI is the probability. So if we're testing the hypothesis that we have a fair die, EI would be 1 over 1,000 times. If we rolled it 1,000 times, should be the number of 1s. Okay? And now the claim, the theorem, is that if you look at this statistic, the sum of the observed minus the expected frequency squared over the expected frequencies, the claim is that asymptotically in the number of occurrences of the random variable, the number of instances of it, it's distributed according to a chi-squared distribution with n minus 1 degrees of freedom. Okay, if this is all gibberish to you, I'm going to do something much simpler in just a second. But this allows us to test that hypothesis. So we compute the statistic, we look at the value, and we have some probability. If this is truly a chi-squared distribution, chi-squared distributions, just to remind you, are the sum of, with k degrees of freedom, is the sum of k squared Gaussian random variables. So we know something about that distribution, and we can compute the statistic and compute the probability that that was, in fact, the value of the distribution given our null hypothesis. And so this allows us to either accept or reject the null hypothesis. Okay. Here's a maybe much simpler way. Okay, so this allows us to test a probability distribution. How do we apply it to two questions? Well, we have two probability distributions. If you give me a question x and a question y, we'll assume that x and y are independent, and that x is 1 with frequency p, and y is 1 with frequency q. And then we have a table for the joint probability distributions. We can go ahead and say, well, if they're independent, the probability that y is 1 and x is 1 is just pq. Okay? And then we have a second probability distribution, the joint distribution for x and y, which is what we actually observed in the data. So we go through and we count the number of times that x really was 1, y really was 1. And this gives us an observed frequency of occurrence for that, for x is 1 and y is 1. Okay? And now we have two probability distributions. We can go ahead and use the chi-squared test to determine whether or not these are independent or not, with some probability. Okay? Let's look at something a little bit simpler, though. If you have any joint probability distribution for these two variables, x and y, they have to satisfy a system of equations. Because if you look at this table, if you sum p11 and p12, it's the probability that y is 1. Okay, so that's q. If you sum p11 and p21, well, that's the probability that x is 1. So you get p. And so on, you can extract many linear equations from this, and you get a system of three linearly independent equations. Okay, so there's really only one parameter living in this table, because you have four unknowns, and three linear, linearly independent equations. Okay? So what does that mean? It means if we look at the independent distribution and the observed distribution, the two are equal up to some parameter alpha times a vector v. Right? This is just, they both lie on a line, and alpha is essentially the distance between them on that line. Okay, so if you take any question x and any question y, the joint probability distribution for x and y will lie on this line, and so the observed as well as the independent, and we have some parameter alpha which measures the distance between the two of them. Okay? And as it turns out, this parameter alpha, if you like, measures how far the questions are from being independent. And so larger values mean more dependent. What you're saying is the observed distribution is a large distance from the independent distribution if alpha is large. If alpha is, say, 0, they're actually the same. Okay? And essentially, almost any metric you take between these joint probability distributions will give you some function of alpha. The Pearson statistic is actually just some function of alpha. It happens to be a nice, organized, well-normalized one, so we'll actually go ahead and use that as an affinity. Okay, so did that make sense? Are there any questions on that? Okay. So this is an extremely noisy affinity in the sense that here is a picture of all pairwise affinities that we got. This is a histogram where I just took the set of all pairwise affinities between all pairs of questions and went ahead and plotted them in a histogram. Okay, so you can see, you notice that you actually do get a Gaussian. You get the absolute value of a Gaussian random variable, which is a nice confirmation. But you'll notice something here. The problem is that many questions are look very strongly related here. You can really only look at questions out on the tails of this distribution. If you look at something, say, close to zero, those affinities have no meaning. There's a very strong component of noise. If you take two random questions, you can expect that their affinity between each other is quite a bit bigger than zero. Okay, so we're only really interested in the tail of the distribution. And we're going to have to figure out how to use just the tail of this distribution in order to define some reasonable affinity between questions. Okay. So far, so good. Does that make sense? Any questions about this particular? Okay. So how can we do this? Well, this is where I'm going to use all that diffusion and eigenmaps and spectral embedding stuff that people keep talking about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a matrix A, and I'm going to put all the pairwise affinities in there. So in other words, I can think of the rows of A as being going over the set of questions, and the columns going over the set of questions. And now I put the entry Aij, mapping the ith row and the jth column, is just the affinity between those two questions, I and J. Okay, and I'm going to threshold this matrix very aggressively. I throw out just about all the information except the tail of that distribution. I'm only interested in questions that I know have a very strong relationship or extremely dependent to each other. Okay, and this is essentially the only information we really get out of this because there's so much noise. If we look at the low level, if we look at all the affinities, it's just nonsense. There's no information.
So you're doing this by setting a threshold, or?
Sure. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, I just threshold the matrix. Okay. And what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to take this matrix and turn it into a Markov process. I'm going to normalize it in some way. In this case, I choose to make the row sums 1. And if you like, what I can do is I take the diagonal matrix of row sums, and I just form the operator of the diagonal inverse times A, which is a Markov chain, a Markov operator. So the sum of its rows is 1. This is just a way of normalizing the operator. And in fact, I started with a nice symmetric operator A. I can threshold in such a way to make A symmetric if I like. So I start with a nice symmetric matrix A, so I go ahead and I'm actually going to consider a symmetric conjugate to the Markov operator. So I don't actually consider this operator T, I define S, which is conjugate to T. And this, of course, has the same eigenfunctions as T, up to this conjugation, which is easy to do or undo if we'd like. Okay. So why did I do this? Well, the problem I have here is that I really don't have a lot of information. A lot of the questions are not directly linked by this. I've thrown out most of my affinities. So if I look at something, so say each of these circles represents a question, I have a red question, a blue question, and a green question, and the red and blue and red and green questions are connected, and maybe perhaps strongly, but I threw out the value connecting the blue and the green question. So I wasn't sure if that was valid or not, so I got rid of it. So what can I do to get some sort of connection between them or figure out how closely they might be related? Well, I can take my Markov operator, and this very simple Markov process is represented by this matrix over here at the right, right? So red would be the first entry, blue the second, green the third, and you see the entries in the matrix just represent the connections of the different questions. So if I square this thing, what I'm doing is I'm propagating information. I create a connection between blue and green because red was strongly connected to blue and red was connected to green. Now I use that information to say, well, maybe blue is connected to green. So I know Peter and Peter knows someone else, so we create a connection that way. So this is how we're going to propagate the extremely limited information we have about the questions.
Are there repeat questions? I mean,
there are no directly repeated questions, but there are very similar questions. There are questions like, I like fire, and I'm afraid of fire.
So do you actually get connections between questions that are not like that?
Yes, you do, actually. I'll show some pictures in a minute, but you actually get a surprising amount of information. So I'm going to take the power of this operator S, and I'm going to look at its, say, spectral decomposition. And I don't know how much has been said in all the different talks about this, so maybe I should do this somewhat carefully. S is a symmetric operator, okay, and it has a eigenfunction decomposition of this form. I have a set of orthonormal eigenfunctions, phi 1 through phi n, and they form basis, and I can write S as a sum this way over its eigenfunctions, okay? And I'm going to define what is usually called the diffusion distance, and this is an affinity on x. And I'm not going to give you too much of a explanation of this, other than this is a way of measuring a distance between x and y. And I don't want to say a whole lot about it because that would be a whole nother talk, but the point here is that you should think of this as a essentially measuring the connection between x and y. And I'm just going to point out that this diffusion distance that I wrote down, I did this for a reason. The punchline is that if I take an eigenfunction and a spectral embedding of this thing, I map the question x to its values phi 1 of x through phi n of x, if I measure the distances in that embedded space, I'm really computing this diffusion distance. And so this, by taking an embedding of my questions into using the eigenfunctions of this operator, I'm measuring this distance. Okay? And you'll notice I can take an nth power because the spectral decomposition of S to the m is the same as the spectral decomposition of S, except I have an nth power of lambda of my eigenvalues. I can take whatever power I want here by just modifying my lambdas. And this changes, I have the same eigenfunctions, but this changes the scaling a little bit of the embeddings, which can have a pretty dramatic effect.
So is there an m missing in your?
Yes, there should be an s to the m. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So again, I'm just taking the embedding phi of x is mapped to lambda 1 to the m, phi 1 of x, lambda 2 to the m. I'm mapping x to this Euclidean vector. And this is the distance function that I am preserving. Okay. So we get to the good stuff. Pictures. Okay, so what happens here? Well, what I'm doing is this is a n-dimensional embedding. In fact, you usually want to truncate this embedding because the eigenvalues will decay pretty fast and you can throw out some low values. What I did is I took a 10-dimensional projection, and you can't draw a 10-dimensional projection. So here I'm drawing some two-dimensional projections. I've chosen two eigenfunctions, and I'm drawing the embedding for those particular eigenfunctions. Okay, so what you can see is that you get these sort of arms coming out from a cloud of questions. Remember that the distance here in the Euclidean space measures some distance between the questions. So what you have is you have a cloud of questions near the origin that are closely connected, and then you have some spikes coming out in this space. If you look in almost any two-dimensional projection here, you'll see something similar. And the natural question is to ask, what are these spikes? And here's a group, here's an illustration of what's going on here. So suppose I look at this little group of questions that I've colored blue. What do I get? This is a one of those two-dimensional projections where I've chosen, I believe, eigenfunction 2 and 3. The first eigenfunction is trivial. Okay, so I get the questions, I would like to be a nurse. If I were a reporter, I would like to report news of the theater. I used to play hopscotch and jump rope. And I've often wished that I were a girl, or if I am a girl, I enjoy being a girl. So I will leave the interpretation to you, but I personally see no relationship between the questions. But. Okay, and let's look at another of the groups. So this is, I know the picture shifts a little bit, but this is actually the same projection. This is this little yellow group down here. So what do I get here? I get, I would like to be a soldier. I like mechanics magazines. If I were a reporter, I would very much like to report sporting news. And I like science. So again, I'm not seeing a relationship. But and again, if you look at these two questions in the middle, you'll see that these little orange questions here are profession jobs that you probably couldn't classify as either male or female. If you look at this little group of red questions, let's see, anyone see that right there? If you look at this little group of red questions, you'll find that these are related to, these are again more profession questions, but less related to being distinctly male or female, and you'll see the same thing. If you look at the green questions there, you'll see profession questions that there's some gradient here. This is not just a cluster. There's actually some sort of gradient going on. As you move away from the outliers, you get some sort of pattern. Less male, less female, more general. Okay. Let's look at another one of these projections. So here, I've chosen another couple of dimensions. I believe these are 5 and 6. And I look at these bluish colored questions, and I get, I have no fear of water. I have a great fear of snakes. I'm not afraid of mice. I do not worry about catching diseases. And let's look at that. That is actually the same, that is actually that spike, the second spike you see in this picture. I just projected it in a different, I've chosen a different projection to view it in. And here I find questions like, sometimes I get so excited that I find it hard to sleep. I have periods in which I feel extremely cheerful without explanation. I have periods where I feel so full of pep that sleep is not necessary for days at a time.
What if the eigenvalues like this graph? I mean, I guess the question is, are these like lots of little connected components, or is there actual little connections?
They're, okay, so these are loosely connected clusters is what's happening. What's happening is you have a cluster of strongly connected questions, another question is strongly connected questions, and there's some sort of...
How many eigenvalues are approximately one?
Are approximately one? None. This is connected, so there's one eigenvalue. There are no actual disconnected components in this graph. It's, and the decay of the eigenvalues is pretty strong. I mean, I think I took, when I did this diffusion, I think it took a 30-second hour or something like that. And, you know, the place where I cut was maybe 10 to minus 3 or 10 to minus 5. So, other questions about this? Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of a cop-out. And for some reason, so I'm actually going to group people in exactly the same way I just group questions. I'm going to view people as completely symmetric to questions. There's not a great, there's no great interpretation of doing this. For questions, we have this nice affinity, and we have this nice relationship, you know, all this Pearson stuff, and we had a great reason for doing this. For people, I'm going to view them as exactly symmetric to questions. I have two people, and I view the answers, and I define an affinity. I view the answers as a vector, and I define the affinity in precisely the same way I did. And I can do the same diffusion process to try and group people. The problem I have with people is that I don't have a good way. I don't have a list of people. I have a list of questions, and I know exactly what the questions are. I don't have a list of people, and so I can't draw pretty pictures that say people are related. What can I do? Well, I'm trying to form rectangles. So I do one of these processes where I play ping pong between the people and the questions. I choose some people that are related to each other. I form some groups of people. Then I use those groups of people and global information to form some groups of questions. And then I use those questions to form groups of people, and so on. I do a curse like this. And the question is, what do I get from doing that? And that's what I'm calling MMPI rectangles. Okay, so these are, what I get by this is some sort of tensor product in this thing. What do these tensor products look like? Well, there's an obvious notion of what low variance means in the case of this survey, and that's that you have a rank one submatrix. That means that I have a group of questions and a group of people, and all the responses of all the people to all those questions were consistent. Not necessarily the same, but predictable, either plus or minus one. Okay, so maybe I'm afraid of everything and you're afraid of nothing, but we're related in the sense that we answered in a predictable fashion to the same set of questions. Okay, so this is the sort of matrix you get when you play this game. You have some group of people and some group of questions, and you see a pattern of repetition with a couple of errors. Okay, there are some differences in our responses, but we more or less answer the same set of questions the same way. And here's another one. In this case, there were 25 people and 11 questions. That's not actually, this was more like 40 by 40, but okay. And this is a slightly less, this is actually at a different scale than that previous rectangle. So there's a little more variation here, not quite as much predictability. Okay, so what am I gonna do with these? Well, so this is what I mean by this talk is more philosophical than anything. I'm trying to say that we need to do things like this, and I don't have a lot of results to show you. In fact, I'm more or less going to stop here. If you want to see the results, we haven't actually had a chance to do everything with this. And this is, unfortunately, this is a difficult data set to work with because we haven't figured out a good way to test whether our groups of people are good or not. We don't have much data defined on this. We're trying to get more. And we've been playing games, taking these subsets of matrices, these rank one blocks. Now we have our organization. When we do something like this spin cycle on it, and we have some preliminary results, but I think if you come back in November for the talk I'm giving then, I should be able to tell you something more. Okay. Well, the theme of this talk is essentially philosophical. I'd like to form groups like this. I should be interested in blocks and subsets of people and some subsets of questions with low variance. I think I'll stop there.